Steve, can you tell us a little bit about your family life situation,
yeah.
please?
Oh, I've been married for 10 years, well, nearly 10 years, and I go to Balmain Anglican Church. I grew up in a Christian household. My father was a Baptist minister for most of my childhood, and then he left the pastoral ministry and became a biblical studies and then history teacher at William Carey Christian School. So I'd like to think that I had a good grounding in the faith that really helped me through the university years. In fact, going to university, as many young people find, can be a pretty daunting experience when you encounter very sort of intelligent people who believe things not only very different from you, but quite opposed to many of the things that you believe. And so having a father who was very well read and had a great library, I think humanly speaking, that was how I got through university and stand here before you.
Mm. So again, thank you for that. A little bit of pre now. So what do you do now? What's 9 to 5 look like for you?
9 to 5. Well, I wish 9 to 5. I teach at several institutions. At Macquarie University, I teach in the political science disciplines. I teach political theory there. I'm right now teaching a course on religion and politics at Macquarie, and I'm really enjoying that. I also teach history at Campion College, which is a Catholic liberal arts college, not far from here actually, in Old Toongabbie, and that's a fantastic place to teach. So I teach Australian history there, Renaissance and Reformation history, Intro to Western Civilization. And then I also teach at an institute called the Lachlan Macquarie Institute, which is an institute run down in Murrumbateman, right near Yass and Canberra. And they train young Christians, and by young we mean really anyone under 55. And it doesn't mean if you're over the hill, if you're over 55, don't worry, but they're the age groups we tend to take, who would like to go out into some area of leadership and make some positive changes in the church and in society. And we run several short courses and a 3-month live-in course where we equip them theologically, worldview-wise, and then place them with successful business people and politicians, and they do an internship, and then they go out and try to do some good. So they're the three institutions that I work for.
Very good. Yeah. Sounds like you're probably well-read also, a bit like your father.
Well, I'd like to think so, but it's not up to me to say.
But you were saying when we were chatting on the earlier that you're involved in doing some research. Can you tell us about that research?
Yeah, please? Well, for the last 3 years, I've been working full-time on a book on basically on Australia's Christian heritage and how we went from being an Anglican jail to the sort of secular state that we are today. And the book is basically a history of the emergence of secularism in Australia. It's about 80% finished, and we've got a contract with a publisher. So this is what I've been working on. So I'm very interested in Australia's Christian colonial period, how that impacted our political, economic, educational institutions. And also I'm very interested, and this is what I'll talk about to some extent today, on how that declined and where we are today as Christians in Australia. So that's what I've been researching full-time for the last 3 years.
So how do you feel that you steer that research into practical, applied information?
I'm a great believer that the church should be a central institution in people's lives, because I think the gospel has so much to offer, not just in salvational terms, but in just coping with what life can throw at us. And so I think for the church to be able to become a central institution in communities again, it needs to some extent to understand how it lost that place, to understand why culture moves the way it does and why it evolves the way it does, and then to try to figure out how it can make a culturally relevant contribution to local communities to facilitate the spread of the gospel. So at the end of the day, it is ultimately about the gospel.
So just so people know, so Steve will have his talk to us very soon. There will be a time for questions afterwards, so please hold your questions to the end if you have them. But a question for some of the organisers, is there a record button for Steve's talk? Does anyone know? Okay, no one who... Okay. Steve, I'll hand it over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank Roger for looking after me and tracking me down and bringing me to this room. I never would have found it on my own. And I also want to thank Richard Bolton for inviting me to come and speak. And so today, I mean, I was asked to speak on the topic, what is the new world's mindset? But I was also told that it would be nice actually to go over some of the things that I spoke about last year and maybe elaborate a bit. So for those of you who came last year and heard me speak, some of this will be familiar, but it won't all be familiar because I want to go a bit deeper into certain topics. And I should also point out that this is not going to be a biblical talk in the exegetical sense of that word. I'm not going to be going through Bible verses and things like that. I'm trusting that other speakers will do that. This is principally me trying to use the taxpayer-funded research that I've been doing for the last 3 years to try to make it relevant to our lives and bring something that I think may be of interest to many of you. Ultimately, what I want to look at is, you know, where was the church and Christianity in Australia, say, in the 1950s? When did Christianity and its relationship with culture start to change? And that will be the 1960s. Where are we today in a worldview sense? And where does Christianity stand today in Australian culture? And what can the church do to try and sort of have a more positive cultural impact for the future? And much of what I say can be related to other Western countries where similar social trends have happened. Okay. Well, I don't think I... This is quite an amazing picture. In fact, many young people were amazed to find out when we were mourning but celebrating the life of Billy Graham recently, to find out that in 1959 he did set the all-time record for the Melbourne cricket ground at about 130,000 attendees. Now that's about 20,000 more than any sporting event has ever held, and it's never been broken, and it probably never will be broken. And of course, you know, he was in the Australasian region doing crusades like this for 3 months. So this just wasn't a one-night thing. He was around Australia and New Zealand and the Australasia region for 3 months doing crusades. And he was doing the same thing in England, doing the same thing in Europe for months, and of course he spent his life doing this in the United States of America. And so this is an incredible cultural moment in Australian history, but also in modern history, where we see the health and at least the seeming health and vitality of religion. It's sort of the high point of Christianity in the 20th century. And very often we look back to this period and we sort of ask ourselves, wow, you know, the good old days, what happened? What happened? Well, only 7 years later. Now remember, Billy Graham went to England and did crusades as well. He met the Queen. But only 7 years later, we read something like this from a popular pop star, John Lennon. Christianity will go. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I'm right and will be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now. I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity. Jesus was all right, but his disciples were thick and ordinary. It's them twisting it that ruins it for me. And then, of course, John Lennon's famous song Imagine, which is basically an atheistic, communistic anthem. So we have a pretty sharp and fast cultural shift that takes place. How does this happen? And those who were there, and I can see some of you were there, you will probably remember that this was an age of incredibly rapid change. One of my students for Australian History 2 years ago was a 72-year-old man, and he lived through all of this, and he said in class, it was great having him talk because he can teach them more about this than I could, but he said it was a very traumatic age, a very traumatic age. So I want to talk about what historians and sociologists say sort of happened. And so as you saw with those Billy Graham crusades, Australia and indeed the Western world has this period of great religious revival after World War II. In fact, World War II was itself a period of great religious revival for both sort of Protestants and Catholics. And yet at the same time, historians and sociologists say clearly something changed. And so what they try to figure out is, well, what socially changed, leading to what we all know in hindsight was a decline in church attendance. And what we also saw was even a decline in Billy Graham's subsequent tours to Australia, and also arguably a decline in religious belief. And so historians focus on certain things, but particularly technology, which works very well with the theme of today. Because what historians say is that it's technological changes more than anything else that led to changes in social religiosity. And so the family car, for instance. Now you might ask yourselves, well, what could the family car possibly have to do with the decline of Christianity? I think some of you probably already know. But what historians say is, and this is actually a really interesting insight, and it's hard for us sort of Gen X's and Gen everything else's to imagine life without a car. But you have to remember that before cars became quite affordable, probably in the 60s, there was really no alternative. There wasn't much of an alternative on a Sunday other than to go to church if you wanted to do something and get out of the house. Remember, the shops are closed. And, you know, the sporting events sort of aren't running like they are today. And so if you want to get out of the house and meet people, well, church is a pretty good option. And so church actually... And look, even I'm old enough to remember the Sunday school picnics. I used to go to the Sunday school picnics as a kid. Bob Menzies would speak at the Sunday school picnics all the time. So, and many of you here remember the Sunday school picnics. In fact, the Sunday school picnic is part of our vocabulary nowadays. If something's really terrible, we'll say it's no Sunday school picnic. But of course, what we all know now is that many millennials don't even know what we're going to mean when we say that. It's no Sunday school picnic. What on earth is a Sunday school picnic? Which just shows how culture is changing. But the family car basically means that on a Sunday, you can go driving up or down the coast or just get away. And so church actually has a competitor. Now, while this is happening over decades, you know, shops start opening on Sundays, theatres start opening on Sundays, and again, church has a competitor. Television is a competitor to church, but also what television starts broadcasting are programs that can be critical of Christianity as well. The big thing, according to historians and sociologists, is the pill. Because what the pill does is it provides for the first time in history an inexpensive and very reliable form of contraception, whereby you can actually control whether you have children or not. Of course, you had contraception before the pill, but it was all a bit clumsy and it wasn't particularly reliable. But what the pill does is that for the first time in history, it separates sex from children. Now, this is actually an incredibly important point, because you have to understand that throughout all of history, as long as everyone knew that if you have sex, you will have children, marriage makes sense. Marriage makes sense, because if you want to have sex, and the overwhelming majority of human beings do, so I hear, then you have to be prepared for the biological consequences of that, children. And if you're going to have children, that means you're going to have to raise these children in some kind of stable economic institution. That's what we call the family. That's what we call marriage. And yet... And so Christian morality, this is the key point. Christian morality, which taught don't have sex outside of marriage, that wasn't even considered morality. That was considered kind of common sense. It's just common sense. If you're going to have sex, it should be in marriage because you're going to have kids. But when the pill comes along and separates sex from children, sex from kids, then Christian morality starts to seem a little bit redundant and quaint. Well, if I can have sex without having children, why do I have to have sex within marriage? That doesn't make much sense. And so in the 1960s, Christianity starts to be seen not so much as immoral, but a little bit too moralistic, sort of a little bit too rigid in its rules. And so what the pill does is that in the social consciousness, it sort of removes culture a little bit further away from Christianity and traditional Christian moral teachings. One of the great Australian historians of secularisation, David Hilliard, says that clergy at the time observed the falling off in weekly church attendance and could only guess at the social causes. They attribute it to the increase in affluence, so people had more money, the rise in car ownership, which enabled suburban families to go away for the weekends, the growth of organised Sunday sport, and the restlessness that pervades the community as a whole, the restlessness, the 1950s and especially the 60s. Another thing that was happening at the time was that a lot of churchmen and the theologians and bishops were actually saying, look, society's changing, we just need to jump on board. So many of the most important church leaders around the world were themselves losing faith in their own Christianity. They were saying, look, people don't believe in God anymore, which is absolute nonsense. Therefore, we need to reconsider whether we need God for Christianity. And so in America, you had the death of God movement. Then you had others saying, look, Christian morality, people don't practice it anymore. Therefore, the church needs to get with the times and it needs to change the way it sees morality in order to keep up. And of course, all this did was, it sort of placed the idea in people's minds, well, if the church is taking its cue from society, well then, by definition, they're following us. We don't need to follow them. Like, we're the leader now. So psychologically, the impact of trying to accommodate the church's teachings to a changing world actually had the opposite effect that it was supposed to have. It was, you know, the churchmen thought that people will find Christianity attractive. All it made people think was that, oh, Christianity is finally admitting its irrelevance and that we've sort of superseded it now. We don't need it anymore. If they want to follow us, fine. But we're going to do what we want to do. To sum up the spirit of the 60s, where all of this is happening, there is sort of one word that I would use, and that is anti-authority. Anti-authority. See, in the 1960s, what is definitely being cast off is the sense that governments, that religion, that churches sort of have an authority over us. And so you have, for example, anti-government authority in these anti-Vietnam War marches that some of you here will remember that took place in the very early 70s, attended by hundreds of thousands of Australians. This was an incredibly radical period in Australia. With the 1960s questioning traditional social mores, and so especially sexual mores, what the pill does is that, again, it sort of separates sex from children, and it allows women to essentially become careerists. This is a very important thing. And so the feminist movement starts to emerge, criticising traditional social views of the family and certainly traditional Christian conceptions of the relationship between men and women. And then, of course, as sexual morality is sort of morphing and that kind of thing, homosexuality starts to become something that people start advocating for. And, of course, many of you know that this year was the 40th anniversary of the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, started in 1978. And so what is going on in all these cases is that people around the developed world are just casting off former authorities, and the notion of any kind of authority starts to become questioned. The only authority that is left, really, is yourself. You're the author of your own life, not God, not the government, not some church, you. And so we live in this culture, a culture emerges of authenticity. Well, as long as you're being true to yourself, And that's something we hear all the time now. Be true to yourself. Be authentic. The authenticity ethic has taken the notion of an objective authority outside of us, which lays down standards for us to live up to. It gets rid of the idea of an objective external authority, and it says the external, the authority is no longer external, it is internal, it is me. No longer are we concerned about authority, we're concerned about authenticity. And so this is what happens. And this is sort of, in a sense, how we have got to things like this. So Christianity, in this social change that has taken place, goes over decades from being something that is just common sense morality and good. Then in the 1960s, when things are changing, it's sort of perceived as a little bit moralistic, a little bit fuddy-duddy, slightly old-fashioned. But as social changes keep going, and we and things like same-sex marriage become culturally accepted, Christianity becomes immoral. It becomes actually dangerous. It becomes a health hazard. And that's where Christianity is at today. And that's why you can go to the news and you can read headlines basically saying that there are battles in schools over whether we should teach the Bible in schools, because the Bible is a health hazard and the Bible is a wicked book. Now, you had battles about the Bible in the 19th century in Australia as to whether it should be taught, but those battles weren't because some thought it was a wicked and immoral book and some didn't. It was because some thought that, well, that's just the Protestants trying to convert the Catholics, and therefore, you know, we can't let them do that in our public schools, so we'll keep the Bibles out. And you can read things now in papers, people saying, well, I'll find a good quote here. You know, it's not okay to make any young person feel that being different is wrong. Messages linking gender identity and sexuality with sin or uncleanliness are archaic, and to suggest something is deeply wrong with people who express their true identity is disturbing. And so again, we're at a point now where Christianity is just seen as positively immoral. And so, of course, that raises the question, well, how free should Christians and Christian institutions be to run their affairs in their own way? Once upon a time, when religion was thought to be a good thing and Christianity was thought to be the sort of the foundation of civilization, the notion that Christian schools and churches should be able to discriminate against anyone who would apply for a job but not uphold their values, that was just considered common sense. Well, of course we would want institutions like churches and church schools to be able to say no to atheists and no to non-believers, because if you let these people in, then that undermines the very institutions and they won't exist much longer over time. They'll disappear. You know, ask yourself, you know, if say the Greens political party stopped discriminating against candidates who held to Greens values and they started letting in candidates who believed in rampant capitalism, closing the borders, cutting down the trees, how long do you think the Greens party would remain the way it is? You know, its enemies would try to join it in droves and change it overnight. Well, it's the same thing with churches and church schools, and that's why churches and church schools want the right to be able to stop people, discriminate against people who would apply for a job who don't believe in their values. And that works when cultural elites see Christianity and see the church as a very valuable institution. But that has shifted over the last few decades, and so now the church has to try to convince a lot of people that it should exist and that it should be able to do what it has to do in order to stay in existence, that is to have the liberty to be able to not hire people who aren't sympathetic with its views. So we're at a point in Australian history where, in fact, we're having a debate over religious freedom. The last time we had debates over religious freedom were over 100 years ago, when people were debating whether Catholic schools should receive funding or whether Catholics should be allowed to be in the public service and be judges. I mean, these things were settled in the 1820s and 1830s. We're having the debates again in some ways because culture has so shifted that Christianity now is now what's on the nose in our modern country. You can see headlines like this now in mainstream papers, the Sydney Morning Herald, marriage equality. We need freedom from religion, not freedom of religion. What makes that possible? Because a lot of people now, because of the cultural changes that took place throughout the 60s and the 70s, see Christianity as immoral. It's immoral. It makes you feel bad about yourself. It tells us things about sin. It says that if your sexual activity is not being expressed in marriage, marriage is defined in the Bible as between a man and a woman, then you are doing the wrong thing. And you should be ashamed of yourself. But shame is not a feeling that is conducive to our self-esteem. And we've got a suicide problem here in Australia. So anything that could possibly make our self-esteem diminished must be a health hazard. And therefore Christianity itself becomes something that is very dangerous in the eyes of many. And that goes back to some of what was said last year at the conference, where the keynote speaker spoke about us being in a therapeutic culture or a happiness culture, where what humans should be looking for most, more than anything else, is not so much a sense that they are not guilty but really a sense that they are happy. The thing is that for Christianity and for most religions, there are good ways of being happy and there are bad ways of being happy. Just because you're happy doesn't mean you're a good person. Yeah? Just because you're happy doesn't mean you're a good person, because you could be pursuing it in the wrong way. That is, you could be pursuing it at the cost of other people's happiness, or the wrong things are making you happy. So what should the church be doing in this climate? So this is the second part of the talk. Is there anything left for the church to do or say, or should the church just be sitting back, either waiting for the inevitable disappearance of Christianity and the return of our Lord, or should it just be sitting back with its fingers crossed, hoping for the best, hoping for revival? Well, I'll talk about revival briefly at the end, but I actually think that the church, that this could in fact be a great opportunity for the church. Here's a headline I came across the other day. So in England, the Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May has just assigned the first office for loneliness. So now the English state, the government, is trying to solve the problem of loneliness. Hey, why not? Now many of us think, wait a second, governments can barely solve the problem of traffic congestion. In fact, we know they can't. You go home after this, it's not going to be as quick as when you came here. They can barely solve that, but now they're going to solve the problem of our deep human longing for community and friendship. Now this sort of says to me that there are increasing social problems that many institutions are finding difficult to address, and so governments are now saying, hey, we've got to step in. And it seems to me that this is going to be a great failure, because governments can't... A government can pay someone a weekly wage to come around and vacuum your house and bring your shopping up to your third-story flat, but a government can't pay someone to be your friend. If someone told you after 5 years of friendship that, oh, by the way, I've been hanging out with you because I've been paid by the government, that would immediately, for most people, that would say, well, you weren't truly my friend. The point that I'm making is that some of our needs in life, some of our very human needs, can't just be engineered by the state. They require an element of human spontaneity. And that's something that the state can't deliver directly anyway. And yet, these are things that arguably the church can do. You see, perhaps the task of the church is to kind of reclaim some of the human ground that it lost over the last 100 years. Once upon a time in the 19th century, if you got sick, you went to a church hospital because they were the ones running the hospitals. If you wanted to be educated, you went to a school that was almost certainly a denominational school. It was associated with a church. If you needed some form of welfare, you would go to the church and they would give you some form of welfare. If you had a question that you needed answered, you would go to a religious authority. The point is that up until relatively recently in history, many of our needs were being met by the church. But then what happens in the 18th, 19th, and especially the 20th century with the Great Depression is that social needs become so intense and so great and complex, and I won't go into why that happens, that the churches don't seem able to cope, and so the state takes over. So the state takes over the hospitals, it takes over the schools, it takes over the welfare system. And what that does from a cultural psychology point of view is that whereas once people saw the church as an important and a very good institution and a relevant institution in their daily lives, it over time becomes an institution of irrelevance. And the problem with that is that when the church is perceived as irrelevant and not particularly impactful on my deepest needs, then its message starts to appear to many to be irrelevant. And so it seems to me that in the modern world, where the way we live, the way we work, is throwing up all sorts of new social problems that, you know, 150 years ago, was throwing up all sorts of new social problems that possibly reversing things. And what I mean by that is that, you know, 150 years ago, 100 years ago, social problems were thrown up that the church couldn't fix. But now it seems that in modern society, new social problems are being thrown up that the state can't fix, but maybe the church would have a much better go at it. And so just that one example of the problem of loneliness. The state can't fix loneliness. What can fix loneliness is meaningful communities. Churches can provide meaningful communities. And so what I'm getting at here is that the church might want to see some of the social issues that have been thrown up over the last 50 years as great opportunities for it to reclaim some of the ground and be able to resituate itself in the centre of local community. So when we think about the problems that this modern, fast-paced, unpredictable economy is throwing at us, and also modern technology is throwing at us, you know, childcare, English language tuition, aged care, loneliness, mental health, especially aged care and mental health, these are huge things that the government struggles with. And yet, and look, I'm not saying that churches can start their own hospitals or things like that, but what I'm saying is that churches might want to start and continue to think creatively about how they can provide services and step into these positions. Because, you know, again, what happens in the 1960s is that people start seeing the church as immoral and ultimately irrelevant. But things since the 1960s have changed so rapidly that, you know, the dream didn't quite work out as they wanted it to. And I'll talk about that in a second. And we've got all these terrible social problems that have emerged. And, you know, all you need is love doesn't quite cut it. And so there's potentially a moment here for churches to step in and show, A, they're not irrelevant, and B, that they can speak into the great human needs of the time better than the government and better than just bumper sticker slogans that aren't particularly comforting in great times of need. So again, the church is taking back some of that cultural ground. Look, we're in an age of great moral social experiments. I think this is an important principle up here for all of us Christians. If Christian morality is right, then it is deeply human. That is, if Christian morality is correct, then it complements us as humans. That's what morality is meant to do. It's meant to be in accordance with our nature as human beings. That means departures from Christian morality must prove to be deeply inhuman in the long run. And so we have to have faith that Christianity will be vindicated in the failure of secular humanism. You know, if you truly believe that the moral laws laid down by God are laid down by God because they are in our interests as human beings, then departures from those laws cannot be in our interests, which means that they will just not conduce to our long-term happiness as human beings. And it's interesting to think that in the 1960s, the authorities of God, the church, government were sort of thrown off. And they thought they'd thrown off all the authorities, but in fact we've discovered one that they didn't even think about at the time, the authority of nature. No one was thinking to question their gender or their sex or anything like that, or whether they were a human being. But nowadays, we're even casting off the authority of nature. So just because you're born looking like a boy doesn't mean you are a boy. And you have on National Geographic this young soul here who tells his parents he is a girl, won't hear a bar otherwise, and so the parents say, right, you must be a girl, and there's the result. A young child. If we as Christians think that this is profoundly at odds with the nature given to us by God to go and do these kinds of things, to engage in these kind of moral scientific experiments, then we have to believe, we have to expect that over time all of this will unravel, that this is not going to work. And anyone who's familiar with literature on transgenderism and those who've undergone operations and things like that will know that people who have undergone transgender operations, still at a rate of 40%, still attempt to take their lives. The point is that it doesn't fix the underlying problems. It doesn't fix the underlying problems. It doesn't work. And then what you're left with, for a lot of them, are people who actually wish they hadn't transitioned, wish that all their friends didn't just encourage them and not suggest to them that maybe they're making a mistake, and now they're stuck, frankly, with mutilated bodies. Well, can you imagine being stuck like that? No. The point is that this will unravel. Moral change does take place when moral experiments fail. A couple of examples. As some of you may know, in the earlier part of the 20th century, eugenics, the idea of creating almost a perfect human race by sterilizing people who were deemed to be unfit, and they were basically people with intellectual disabilities or people who were just deemed socially lazy, and that was often directed towards African Americans. And this is the origins of Planned Parenthood, started by Margaret Sanger. It started out as a racist eugenics organization. A lot of people don't remember that. So eugenics is big business among intellectuals in the earlier 20th century. But, you know, World War II happens and, you know, actually you see a bit of eugenics in action in Germany. And suddenly people say, ooh, maybe this is a dangerous idea. Maybe we shouldn't be talking about the government, you know, trying to create, you know, a better human race via sterilization, because that might be a little bit dangerous, because you've got to have a pretty trustworthy government, and governments haven't proven too trustworthy in the 20th century so far. And so eugenics really fell out of favor with intellectuals for decades and decades. The point that I'm making is something that intellectuals and many people thought was just obvious scientific truth and great morality, it was shown to be a really dangerous thing. And eugenics then sort of quieted down. It's making a slight comeback now, but environmentalism. Yeah, once upon a time, environmentalists were just seen as a bunch of crazy weirdos. But what happens is that, you know, industrialization does more and more bad stuff to the environment, and suddenly environmentalism starts to make sense. Another one, the sexual revolution in the 1960s. Well, you know, with this whole Me Too business of late, people have started saying, well, look, this idea that, you know, that sort of sex should, you know, just be the older views of sex within marriage don't work and they're oppressive. Maybe actually we need to sort of rethink that and maybe put more boundaries around sexual behaviour, because in fact the legacy of the 1960s of free love has really turned out to be something that's been pretty good for a lot of men, but not so good for a lot of women. And so people are now thinking a little differently about the sexual revolution of the 1960s, especially not just in light of rampant sort of sexism, but also in the light of the harmful effects of pornography. Now, pornography, in the 1970s, if you spoke out against pornography, people would have just thought you were a crazy religious nut job. Nowadays, if you speak out against it, it's acceptable. Views of pornography have actually changed over the last 40 years. They've changed over the last 40 years. Why? Because people have seen that the experiment in getting rid of all censorship around pornography has failed terribly. And you're getting, 10, 11, 12-year-old girls going into doctors with sex injuries because their boyfriends just fill their heads with pornography. And of course, the girls don't know any better. They want to please their boyfriends. We're just not built for that. And of course, the shocking impact that pornography has on just the way men and women relate to one another. You fill your head with that kind of toxic garbage. Well, good luck trying to have a normal relationship with a normal woman. It just won't happen. And that's what a lot of men are experiencing in their marriages. So people don't speak about pornography the way they did 40 years ago. Oh, it's a bit of fun. Mind your own business, you old fuddy-duddy. No, because the experiment has been shown to fail. That brings me back to the principle that if the way we think about morality deviates from the way God says we ought to relate to one another, Christian morality, then it cannot but fail. It has to fail. We as Christians have to believe that it will fail. And it is. And of course, the transgenderism thing. Last slide. So what can we do? Well, I honestly believe that we do actually need to be praying and fasting for revival. And there are many who believe that revival, people predict the death of Christianity in the 21st century, but then there are a lot of people who actually say no, Christianity flourishes most when it is most threatened. And in fact, the more likely its death is, the more likely its revival will become. And when you ask yourself, well, what are the alternatives? What are the social alternatives to Christianity? Well, we've seen some of them. What happens when you abandon a Christian vision of humanity? What you're left with? And then, of course, you've got the Islamic issue, especially in Europe. And the point is that it is not an obvious truth that Christianity is not going to survive the 21st century. Christianity is flourishing in China, it's flourishing in Africa, it's flourishing in parts of South America. Revival is a definite possibility, absolutely. Here's something that's true. We can't control culture. There's no formula for controlling culture, but we can influence culture when it's ready to be influenced. Martin Luther doesn't offer a new message in 1517. What he said had been said earlier. It had been said back in the 4th century by St. Augustine. But what is new in 1517 is that there is a printing press. There is greater collaboration and communication between states and peoples. So the message that Martin Luther gave, which was lost and quashed very easily earlier on in earlier centuries, suddenly becomes something that can't be destroyed and can't be controlled. The point is that culture has its moments where it's ready for change. And we need to recognise the present needs that the church can best address. And so when we are addressing these needs, we prove to communities that in fact the church is a really moral, relevant institution. So when that moment comes, or that opportune moment, that kairos moment, sort of that biblical word kairos, meaning an opportune time, when it comes, we are ready. That we're ready for that. Now, what am I talking about doing? Well, what I'm talking about is that the church, by continuing to critique culture, and by trying as much as possible to meet certain cultural needs that the state cannot meet, the church is, in a sense, thawing the frozen soil. Thawing soil that over the last 50 years has frozen, making the seed of the gospel just bounce off it in many cases. For people to take the gospel message seriously, humanly speaking, there's all sorts of cultural baggage that needs to be sort of cast off. The notion that the church is immoral, the notion that the church is irrelevant. And when you can resituate the church in communities, then the gospel can be planted again more effectively. I'm speaking, of course, in human terms. See, Christianity is both true and it is human. And so the more we deviate from Christianity, the more inhuman our way of thinking about one another becomes. And so we as Christians have to stay faithful to our gospel, and we have to stay faithful to our Christian way of living, which means our marriages have to live up to our standards. Our relationship with pornography has to live up to what we say pornography is. We have to live according to our own principles, and we have to not lose faith in our own message, because we must be faithful that this cultural departure from Christianity will not work. And the most terrible thing that could happen is that at that moment when everyone realizes that it has failed, that Christians aren't ready for that moment where they can say, here's a much better alternative, look how it's been operating, why don't you give it a try, and something else takes that place. Okay, thank you very much.
We have an opportunity now for questions of Steve. I'll ask Steve, after you've asked your question, he'll repeat it so that everyone can hear it well, and we'll do that for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll close. So, are there any questions? That was the quickest hand here.
Steve, what's the fate of churches that hop on the pendulum and swing with the norms of social change?
The question is, what is the fate of churches that hop on the pendulum or the bandwagon of social change? Well, when they hop on the bandwagon of social change in the sense that they start caring more about being socially relevant to people who would otherwise have no interest in Christianity, we know the answer to that, and the answer is that these churches just decline in numbers. So there was a famous book written a couple of decades ago, you know, Why Conservative Churches Are Growing, implication being that liberal churches are declining, they're failing. And the problem, the psychological problem when you jump on the cultural bandwagon and you start saying, well, we need to abandon our traditional morality, is that, quite frankly, you're like the kid in the playground, giving away all these toys, thinking, oh, I'm giving away all my toys, people are going to like me and they're going to want to follow me, they're going to want to be my friend. But of course, the kid who gives out all these toys, people have nothing but contempt for that kid. And that's what the church is like when it starts just conceding ground to innovative morality and other things like that. It doesn't appear to be progressive. It appears that it itself has lost faith in its own message. And if it's lost faith in its own message, why on earth would we want to join it? It can join us. And the number, and that speaks to the numbers of the attendees of these what we might call liberal churches. I hope that's okay.
Would we be talking about the Episcopal Church in?
Yes, the Episcopal Church in the US. I'm being asked what particular churches. Yes, the Episcopal Church. Yes, the Uniting Church of Australia. Yes, no doubt. I'll let you do that, Roger. Yeah.
As Christians, our knowledge of the gospel gives us a little bit of an insight into the dangers in what some social trends will lead to. But when we speak up, we're told the slippery slope argument is invalid.
Ah.
Is there a better way to argue that, or is there a different way completely to talk?
wow, the slippery... I've been asked that when sort of Christians point out that these cultural experiments are going to lead to all sorts of negative social consequences, the response is, that's a slippery slope argument, that's invalid. Look, I've written a bit about the slippery slope argument, and my response... And by the way, the notion of a slippery slope argument is the notion that, well, any argument that says that we shouldn't do X because X is going to lead to a whole bunch of negative consequences, well, that's an invalid argument. My response to that is that all public policy, all law, asks the slippery slope question. So, for example, if there's a public policy about, say, let's say there was a public policy question, we've had a bunch of assaults in King's Cross, they're all alcohol-fueled, what should we do about it? And someone comes along and says, oh, I know, we'll ban alcohol in King's Cross. We'll ban alcohol in King's Cross. The first question any responsible public policy analyst would ask is, well, what are the possible negative consequences of that? It might be with all the good effects, but what are the possible negative consequences? Will it drive alcohol consumption underground? Will it create a new black market in alcohol consumption? Will it lead to the unjust shutting down of many legitimate businesses in that area? The point is, that is a slippery slope argument. The person is asking, what are the negative consequences? We do it with all public policy, everything. Any public policy expert who doesn't ask the first question, that is, what are the possible negative effects of this, is thoroughly irresponsible. So the response to them is, in actual fact, this is why the slippery slope argument is valid, and if you don't think it's valid, then you're totally irresponsible. If I can, that would be my approach. I'm sure there are other ones, but... Yeah.
I have a question just about Billy Graham. I read in an article that the article said that Billy Graham's impact in the 1960s or 59 post was disproportionately high in Australia as compared to England or even America. I don't know if you've heard this claim, but if you have, do you have any clues as to why?
I've been informed that historians say that Billy Graham's impact in Australia was disproportionately high in comparison to his impact in America and his impact in England. First, I'm no expert in Billy Graham. I didn't know that, so that's very interesting. Now, why would that be? Oh, look, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't know. I won't even try. But thank you. I greatly appreciate that question. I'm going to go look into that. That's fantastic. I'll be very interested to find out where you got that, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, Mike, that's the last question, sort of in the white shirt there. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if we have to be a bit careful in lamenting some of that lost influence of Christianity in our culture. I mean, just think about people that gave up church.
Yeah.
In the first place. Yep. And, people that have faith in Jesus know that it's best for one man to be with one woman, to be committed. And, that doesn't change because, she can have a deal. So I'm really questioning, I guess.
Yep.
I mean, I agree with you. All the things that you criticise, I'm 100%
yep.
behind. But how committed were those people? And maybe it's better that
Yep. That's a great question. The question was, how much should we really lament the cultural Christianity that seemed to decline in the 1950s and 60s, the implication being, well, that those that stopped going to church simply because they got a car couldn't have been too... too committed in the first place. So maybe it's a good thing. Maybe sort of the loss of a kind of cultural and sort of elite institutional, hegemonic, to use a terrible word, Christianity is actually a good thing. It's taught us who the true Christians are, maybe. Am I paraphrasing you okay, sir? Great, great. Well, I mean, you make a good point, but the thing I would just point out is, and again, we're just talking in human terms, you know, we are cultural beings. And I'm certainly not arguing for the idea that Christianity should become a sort of a part of the establishment in any way, but we are cultural beings, and we tend to take the things that we value and our notion of right and wrong and our general moral principles from a surrounding culture. And if that surrounding culture refuses to acknowledge things like guilt, or refuses to acknowledge things like personal responsibility, or is positively hostile to those terms, or is hostile to the idea that the church and Christianity and God can be of any goodness or relevance in society, then humanly speaking, that does create a stumbling block for people to accept the message of the gospel, because the message of the gospel presupposes an acceptance of a whole bunch of propositions that we don't even think about. So it presupposes the idea that you can be guilty, that there are things that you do that you should be ashamed of. It presupposes, and if you don't believe that you can be sort of guilty or that there are things that you should be ashamed of, then the notion that you need a redeemer isn't going to hold much water. And so the point is that the gospel message operates in a broader cultural context, and it seems to me that much of that broader cultural context is something that is culturally being given to us by the church. And so if the church can sort of speak more effectively into wider culture through softening some of the hostility against the church and against the idea that the church and Christianity can have any kind of social or existential relevance, then that can't but be a good thing for the gospel. I'd want to distinguish between sort of Christianity kind of ruling the institutions and just a common appreciation for the usefulness and goodness of Christianity. And I think it would be a shame if we finally lost the latter completely, because I think that can only be, again, in human terms, detrimental for attempts to preach the gospel to people. So that would be my answer.
Let's finish it there. I'm sure Steve would probably be happy to answer some more questions in a more informal manner if you have them, just once we've closed. We have lunch coming up now, so what I'm going to do is say grace for us, and then we'll be able to occasionally move out. Let's bow our heads and pray.